I don't know what your experience is, but when I was little, and we're talking early 70s here, one of my fond memories was riding in this car. This was my grandmother's Oldsmobile 98. Well, this isn't exactly the car, same color, same year, same everything. This is what it looked like. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, an Oldsmobile was a kind of car. They're not around anymore. And the 98 was the big one. This was a cushy, sweet ride. And even at 4 years of age, I knew this was a great car. Matter of fact, I knew it was better than my parents' car. And I think some of it was that my grandma only had kids in the car only once a week. I think that's why it was nicer than my parents' car. We rode in that car for various things. I can remember when growing up in Illinois, we would travel to northern Wisconsin in that car, and sitting in the back seat was like sitting in a couch, just so soft and cushy. But it wasn't just that. I also remember going on Sunday drives. Any of you remember something called a Sunday drive? Some of you do. It's horrifying, right? You think about it in these days and you're like horrified that you would do something called going on a Sunday drive, getting in a gas-guzzling car with no emission system, using leaded gas, and driving for no apparent reason. It makes me embarrassed. Now, for those of you who did not grow up in the 70s, we didn't think about this because this was long before the energy crisis, which is probably something else you don't really know about, but that's okay. But this is what old people used to do. And if that wasn't reckless enough for you, we also would drive around in these cars, and most likely an adult would be smoking a cigarette with the windows up with little kids in the car too. Does anybody remember that? I'm not going to name names of my family, but it happened, right? And then, let's add to that, my grandma was deeply concerned that when we would go on a Sunday drive, that being, you know, 4 or 5 years old, that I wasn't tall enough to see out the window, so she would put me in the front seat on the armrest in the middle, so I'd have like a booster seat, so I could see over the dashboard and see everything without a seatbelt. I mean, could you imagine? That was my life. But the routine was this. Sunday we'd go to church, and after that we would all pile into grandma's car, and we all fit because this is a huge car, and we would go out for Sunday dinner. And whether the Sunday dinner was close or far, it wouldn't make any difference. We would have dinner, and if the destination was far away, we would drive through the countryside, or if it was in close, then we would just take an extra trip out into the countryside to burn some gas before going home. It was just a thing. We didn't know better. I know it's not an excuse, but we didn't know better. But it was aimless driving to enjoy the scenery, and what I'm going to tell you is that is not how Jesus operated. He knows where he is going, he has a destination in mind, and he knows what he's going to do once he gets there. We've been looking at the Gospel of Mark for the last 4 weeks, but Luke, who also wrote a story about Jesus, puts it this way, and I think this is really fascinating. This is how Luke describes what Jesus is about. He says, as the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. In other words, this was no Sunday drive. He knew where he was going, and he knew what he had to do. Matter of fact, I highlighted that word resolutely because it's the only time it shows up in the entire Bible. And it's not one word in the original language, it is two words. And it would be literally translated this way, Jesus firmly faced Jerusalem. In other words, he was not going to walk away from this thing, but he was going to walk towards it. And if you were listening as Robin read, you know what that it is. He's going to die. So we've been on this journey together over the last 4 weeks, and Jesus has been all over the place. We began at Mount Tabor, which was right close to his boyhood home. He went up to Capernaum, which was his home base for his ministry. Then he travels all the way down into Judea, across the Jordan. Last week we talked a little bit about that. And then he moves his way west, heading towards Jerusalem. Now here's the thing. It's a dark thing. It's a somber thing that Jesus is actually making his way towards his own death. I mean, that is pretty dark, right? And now he is in that final kind of walk. Next week, we'll hear how he passes through Jericho on the way to Jerusalem, which, by the way, it is right in his path of where he is headed. Now, Mark doesn't say Jesus resolutely sets his face towards Jerusalem, but this is how Mark says it. They were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. So even Mark, in his own way, says, yeah, Jesus is out front and he knows where he's going and he knows what he is about. But there's a twist to this. Listen to this. The rest of the sentence says, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Now that's a twist, because you have to remember, at this point, Jesus hasn't shared within this group why he's going to Jerusalem. You assume it's for the Passover, and yet the disciples were astonished and those who followed were afraid, which only makes me think that was not how Jesus normally walked when he had a group of people. He might have had kind of somewhere in the middle of that group, talking and visiting and sharing and teaching as he was walking along. He was never out front. I mean, he knew where he was going, but he was always within the group interacting. But this time, he's out front. He's got something to do, and it's making people uneasy. There's some tension in the air. And Jesus, of course, being the Son of God, realizes this. And he pulls his disciples aside for just a moment. And he says something that we all know. We're going up to Jerusalem, he said. And the Son of Man, which is how he referred to himself, the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death, and they will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. Now here's the thing. This would be shocking to hear if it was the first time that he said this to the disciples. He's already told them this very thing two other times. But he keeps telling them because it's not sinking in. Can you imagine? He keeps telling them, and they don't comprehend it, they don't absorb it, that this is the thing he is actually going to do. So this is the third time in short order that he has told them. Now, as I was looking at not just this, but really the entire story that Mark tells, here's the thing that you need to know if you just read Mark. Jesus tells us what is going to happen, but not why it is going to happen. That is really fascinating that Mark would write this gospel, and that as he relayed the story of Jesus, all we hear is what is going to happen, but not why. I would imagine that even if Jesus told them why, and Mark relayed it, the disciples wouldn't care. They don't care why Jesus is going to die. They're more concerned about their leader, their rabbi, their teacher, the one that they love. They don't care about why they're going to Jerusalem if they know that's going to happen. They're more concerned about the person of Jesus than the reasons behind going to die. But here's the thing. If we could go back in time, back to the earliest of the church. And Mark is the earliest of the Gospels, if you didn't know. If we could go back in time and we only had the Gospel of Mark, because remember, the New Testament came together slowly, right? But if we only had a copy of the Gospel of Mark, and we had to make some sense of Jesus' mission, do you have any idea what we would discover if we only had the Gospel of Mark? Well, believe it or not, I spent some time this week reading everything that Jesus said in the Gospel of Mark. Thank God for red lettering in a Bible. I'm just telling you, that makes things so much easier when you just want to read the words of Jesus. And here's what I discovered, is that Jesus is going to die and rise again to show his disciples, to show his followers, and to show the world that he alone is more powerful than the Roman Empire, the Pharisees, the temple itself, and the chief priests. Jesus is above and beyond any government, any organized or even disorganized religion. Jesus is far and above more powerful than any human institution created. Those who tried to control Jesus killed him. But what they discovered is you can't beat God. Jesus, who is the Son of God, even submitted to their plan of destruction, and he's still victorious. God is more powerful than human scheming and more powerful than death. And Jesus, in the Gospel of Mark, will show his disciples that he is God and that humanity and its institutions are no equal to the power of God. Okay. But it's more than that. You know what else you discover if you just read the words of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark? He does not once talk about dying to forgive the sins of the world. Not once. In the Gospel of Mark, though, Jesus does talk about the importance of us forgiving one another. And once he even says he has the authority to forgive sins, but nothing related to his death and resurrection. It's really fascinating. But as we know the story, because we are Christians and we're on the other side of this, that Jesus enters into Jerusalem during Holy Week, that's what we call it, and he flips the script and shows his true power in what appears to be a moment of desperation and weakness. So you put all that together. And it appears that Mark, this gospel writer, is communicating a question to us. And here's the question. Who are you going to follow? God or a human like yourself? Or a humanly created institution? Like the old Bob Dylan song, you got to serve somebody. I think Bob Dylan understood, as well as God understands, that we subject ourselves to individuals or to something else, that we are just kind of wired or created in our brokenness to follow something or someone. And what Mark does is he makes the case that it should be Jesus and nothing else. Okay, now that I got that off my chest, let's get back to the story. So Jesus tells everybody, okay, so here's the deal. I'm going to Jerusalem to die. I'm going to suffer, I'm going to die, and then I'm going to rise again in 3 days. If they were astonished before he told them this, they should be shaking in their boots now, but they're not. They're not. Listen to this. Right after Jesus says this, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him and, "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." I mean, could you imagine? That is the follow-up to the person you've been following for 3 years who just said, "I'm going to die." And they're like, "Well, we have a question first. Before we get to all that dying stuff, I got a question for you." This is the same thing that we, Rachel and I, encountered off and on when our kids were small, right? They come to us, they want something, and they would say, we're going to ask you something, but you have to promise you'll say yes first. Did anybody else ever have that in their household? We're going to ask you, but you have to say yes. Promise me you'll say yes, and then I'm going to ask you. No, I'm not going to promise to say yes. Sorry, just, you know. It was low-hanging fruit. Yeah. So that's what they do. Promise, and he's like, no. He bites. He's like, okay. Ask me the question, but I'm not promising you that I'm going to say yes. What do you want? And they replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. Wait, what? What? Why are you asking this question? Jesus just said, I'm going to go die. And you're like, yeah, but we want to be like your number two and number three guy when you're in charge. Yeah. Okay, we get it. You're going to die. Okay, fine. Do what you got to do. But we want to be your vice president and secretary of state when all this stuff gets sorted out. What? This is such a non sequitur in this moment. They literally ignored everything he just said again because they had an agenda. They weren't listening to comprehend. They weren't listening to understand. They were just waiting for a break to chime in with what they wanted. It's laughable, but we do this. This is human. It's human nature. I mean, it's almost laughable because if you didn't laugh, you'd pretty much cry at this point with the way they're acting. And when they say, we want to sit at your right and left hand, the illusion is sitting on a throne. You know, we want to be in, the way a king sits on a throne, we want to be in power with you. But that's not a part of God's master plan in the short term. It's not even close. But they wanted more. They didn't realize that the cross comes before the crown. They didn't realize that suffering precedes glory or perfection. Now, the story continues, and the other 10 disciples overhear this, and it says they got mad or indignant. I'm pretty sure it was mad that they didn't think of it first and ask first, right? Like, oh man, they totally beat us to the punch. We wanted to be the number two and three guys. Or they read Jesus' facial expression when they asked this question. They realized, oh, this is a terrible question. We're taking Jesus' side. That is terrible, James and John. I can't believe you actually did that. They're all clueless. It's not these two, it's all of them. So Jesus sets the record straight by repeating himself again. If you've been journeying with us, 3 weeks ago, Jesus taught his disciples a lesson on who is the greatest in the kingdom of God. And the reason he had to teach this lesson was that while they were walking, the disciples were having a hush-hush whispered conversation about who was the best disciple. So in other words, we've already covered this ground. Jesus already explained what it means to be great in the kingdom of God, and we're right back at square one. So Jesus pulls them aside again. He turns down the request for a promotion, and he clarifies once again. Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man, how he refers to himself, did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So Jesus explains once again that greatness is what you do for others, not what others do for you. Using that definition, though, and I said this 3 weeks ago, is that we all have the opportunity to be great in the eyes of Jesus, and it isn't just reserved for the number two and number three person on the left and right of Jesus' throne. So with that, we kind of have to close off here, but as you know, this continues. And so we're headed west towards Jericho and then on into Jerusalem. So with that, I say to be continued and amen.